KaiserNetwork.org.
Talking earlier. Good evening, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, colleagues and friends, welcome to the 2007 National HIV Prevention Conference. Bienvenidos y bienvenidas. Y para aquellas personas que necesitan traducción, tenemos traducción instantánea. Pueden pasar a la parte de atrás y recoger sus audífonos. El servicio es gratis. Solo tienen que dejar su tarjeta de presentación. Standing before all of you is such an honor. You represent many of the best minds in HIV prevention research, HIV prevention program and policy in our country, and perhaps the world. Many of you have dedicated your entire lives to working with communities to preventing the spread of HIV infection, and many of you have been doing this for over 20 years. It is a wonderful opportunity to have those involved both in research as well as those dedicated to delivering HIV prevention programs in one large room. This is going to be an amazing meeting with over 2,600 participants already registered, and we are expecting a further 300 to 400 participants over the next couple of days. This will be our largest national HIV prevention conference with more than 122 sessions, 422 presentations, and 250 posters. I'd like to begin by thanking our 36 co-sponsors of this conference for making this meeting possible. I'd also like to acknowledge the support of the other two conference co-chairs, Dr. Victoria Cargill of the National Institute of Health and Dr. Timothy Mastro, also of the CDC, as well as our conference organizer, Mr. Bob Komischer. Now, we have many speakers who are keen to greet you today, and we'll first hear from Mayor Shirley Franklin. Now, in 2001, the people of Atlanta elected Shirley Franklin, a first-time candidate for public office, to serve as the 58th mayor of the city of Atlanta. She became the first mayor of Atlanta, first female mayor of Atlanta, and the first African-American woman to serve as mayor of a major southern city. Mayor Franklin is widely regarded as one of the most effective mayors in the country. Since her inauguration in 2002, Mayor Franklin has worked diligently to make Atlanta a best-in-class managed city by restoring financial stability and making tough decisions that have resulted in 5 balanced budgets. In 2005, Time magazine named Franklin as one of the 5 best big city American mayors. In October of the same year, she was included in the U.S. News and World Report Best Leaders of 2005 issue. Ladies and gentlemen, Mayor Shirley Franklin.
Good morning. I'm Atlanta Mayor Shirley Franklin. I sincerely welcome each of you to our great city and home of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Atlanta is known for its southern hospitality, and we are extremely proud of our new Georgia Aquarium, our museums, parks, restaurants, and historic sites, which I'm sure you will enjoy while you're here. I am very happy that this conference is in our city. Like many other urban areas, Atlanta is significantly impacted by HIV and AIDS. We need a conference like this one, where it is safe to have open discussions about this devastating health crisis. It is my sincere hope that this conference will help all of us learn how to be more effective in addressing HIV/AIDS in our communities. Thank you for your attention. Have a great conference and enjoy Atlanta.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce our next guest to the podium to provide welcoming remarks. Dr. Julie Gerberding is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, and the administrator of the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, ATSDR, and has held this position since July 2002. Prior to coming to CDC, Dr. Gerberding was a University of California at San Francisco UCSF faculty member and directed the Prevention Epicenter, a multidisciplinary research, training, and clinical service program that focused on preventing infections in patients and their healthcare providers. She has authored or co-authored more than 140 peer-reviewed publications and textbook chapters and contributed to numerous guidelines and policies relative and relevant to HIV prevention, post-exposure prophylaxis, management of infected healthcare personnel, and healthcare-associated infection prevention. On a personal note, since joining CDC in January of last year, Dr. Gerberding has been a tremendous source of support, a strong and active supporter and advocate for Centers for Infectious Diseases, programs, and initiatives. Whether as a national spokesperson for HIV testing, Women and Girls HIV/AIDS Awareness Day, World AIDS Day, or her strong and articulate voice on the need for the revitalization and refocusing on HIV prevention in the United States or overseas, Dr. Gerberding's personal and professional interest in and commitment to HIV prevention provides continued inspiration for all of us at CDC. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Julie Gerberding.
Hello. It's really an honor to be here, to have a chance to welcome all of you to a very, very important meeting. I want to especially thank Dr. Fenton and the team from the National Center for their extraordinary leadership and for the partnership that they've shown with so many agencies, not just across our government and governments elsewhere, but across our nation and our state and local health departments and the people in the community organizations who are the true front line of this disease. On Friday, I had a chance to go over to the Emory campus to look at the quilt, the 800 panels that were displayed there. And as I stand here in this room and the quilt is around us here, when I walk into the headquarters building of the CDC every morning, I'm greeted with panels of the quilt. I can't ever completely leave the HIV epidemic, and I can't ever completely separate myself and my history from these problems. I've been involved with this disease for 26 years, and I think we can look back on those 26 years and see some tremendous progress and some tremendous change and some tremendous reasons to be hopeful. But I think we also can acknowledge and appreciate that there have been an other side to that coin. And while we've all read A Tale of Two Cities and we know the quote that I'm about to read you, I think it's a fitting beginning for our discussion at this meeting to go back and review those first lines, because they really do, in my opinion, completely describe the state of our challenges today. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epic of belief. It was the epic of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. And of course, it goes on. You know, The Tale of Two Cities is a moral tale. It's a tale that has themes of death and guilt, shame, and social injustice. But it's also a tale that has themes of redemption and resurrection and great hope. We look at our current situation with HIV/AIDS, not just in this country, but on an international frame, and I think we see both. We see the negative and we see the positive, and the challenge is really for us to be able to move forward. Let's just think about some of the trends. There's a yin and yang to each of them. We can talk about the vaccine and the hope for ultimately a preventive vaccine. We have many candidates. We've proven that it's possible to construct and execute a very large-scale international clinical trial. But the trial failed to show protection. We have incredible HIV treatments now, and we are using those treatments across our nation and across the world to literally save lives and to result here in the United States in a 4% reduction in the death rate, at least since between 2001 and 2005. That's a wonderful, wonderful positive. But it comes with the recognition that access is challenging here, and it's almost impossible in many parts of the world, that those drugs are not magic bullets, that those adverse events are very real for the people who are experiencing them, and that drug resistance is always going to be our next challenge. We've also have, I think, some extraordinarily hopeful changes in the picture of how HIV is being transmitted. Again, just looking at data from 2001 and 2005 in the places that have named reporting, we can see that there's been a remarkable reduction in cases among women, among injection drug users, among children, and among young teenagers. But unfortunately, that is not the picture for older teens and adults, particularly those from ages 35 to 39, and it's certainly not the picture for African Americans, men who have sex with men, and Hispanic and Latino populations who are all disproportionately reflected in the statistics that are reported. One of the things that I hope we will be able to talk about in future HIV meetings is the true incidence of infection. We're getting closer and closer, and I know there are controversies about the reported estimates and the new calculations, but I just want to say that until we have HIV incident reporting in every jurisdiction in our country, we're at best always going to be extrapolating that information. I'm an epidemiologist, and I think that we all need to insist that we get to a point where we can accurately and reliably know the who, what, when, where, how, and how many of this disease if we ever have a chance to shine the brightest light on the problems that need the most attention. The last thing, of course, is the investment. We are making the largest investment in HIV/AIDS that's ever been made. But we're also seeing the largest number of people with this disease that has been present since the epidemic began to unfold. And whatever we're spending, and whatever we're doing, and whatever progress we make, we're not doing enough until there are no more panels in the quilt and until the incidence of new infections is zero. I hope you have a wonderful meeting, and I pledge CDC and the leadership that is represented here to continue to try to do our part to fight for the vision of zero transmission. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gerberding. I'm honored to introduce our next guest. In August 2002, Christopher Bates was named Acting Director for the Department of Health and Human Services Office of HIV/AIDS Policy. He is a senior health program analyst who also served as the National Director for a departmental initiative known as the Rapid Assessment, Response, and Evaluation. Before joining OHAP, Christopher worked in a variety of HIV/AIDS and public health-related initiatives, including John Snow, the City of Philadelphia HIV Commission, the Executive Director of the DC Comprehensive AIDS Resources and Care Consortium, an alliance of local organizations and institutions that provide HIV/AIDS services and educational services in the District of Columbia. Before 1991, Christopher enjoyed a successful 11-year career as a program director and in various management positions within the District of Columbia government. Christopher is simply an inspiration to those of us working within HHS on HIV/AIDS issues. He serves as a central point of advice and a constant source of support in navigating both the minefields and the opportunities of national HIV/AIDS policy issues. He is an acknowledged national advocate for AIDS, as well as a provocative, civic, gay and lesbian activist in the District of Columbia. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Christopher Bates.
Good afternoon. I can't hear you. Thank you. I know you're out there because I hugged a few of you. It gives me great pleasure to be here this afternoon to represent the Department of Health and Human Services at this HIV prevention conference. But I'm extremely glad to be here because once again I get to be with friends and family, people I've been working with for the last 23 years, and it's always important for us to reconnect during the course of the year and to support one another in the work that we do. So before I get into the formalities of my acknowledgments, I just want to say to all of you, thank you for continuing to kick butt out there on the streets of America every day, because without you, this epidemic would be further out of hand. So thank you, and give yourselves a round of applause, because you make the difference. I want to thank the CDC for inviting me, because they, you know, they never know what I'm going to say, and they're always a little bit suspicious that I might go, you know, off message and get them and me in trouble. But today I'm going to stay within the lines, as best I can. This is an important time, as Dr. Gerberding pointed out. And in the face of all of the trials and tribulations that you all face on the front line each day doing this work, there have been lots of successes. But those successes ride on the back of sometimes not enough money to do the work you need, not enough training to develop specialty skills in various areas, and other times not having enough people just available to share this experience with in a most intimate and personal way. I hope that you, as healthcare workers and HIV prevention workers on the front line, take care of each other and one another back at the home site. You're important to this epidemic, because without you, we cannot do this. We can't do this from the federal level. They can't do it from the state level. It's you on the ground in local communities and cities and towns and rural communities that really do this true work. I made a personal commitment about a year and a half ago to not only my family, because I have a couple of family members who are challenged by HIV, but also to my friends in D.C. and to this nation, to put myself in a place to take an active role in this response to the AIDS epidemic, aside from the work that I do as the fifth-year acting director of the Office of HIV/AIDS Policy, to take it upon myself to get engaged. And I went to see Kevin, and I talked to my colleagues and friends at the CDC, and I said, I want to do something too. So they support me, and they've allowed me to take on what you see behind me is a national HIV testing community mobilization campaign. I'm excited about this campaign because it's got one message: take care of your health, take care of your life, get tested for HIV. I think it's an important message. But for me to get this message out in a way that we get people into HIV testing opportunities, that we find people among that 250,000 that we know are probably HIV infected but don't know their status, that we get those folks tested, we identify them, we move them into care and treatment services, and then we get them the support that they need. To do that, I'm going to need some of you to help me. So I have a booth here with my colleagues and friends and my contractors in the exhibit hall, and I'd like for some of you to stop by and see whether or not you'd like to be one of our associates to help us get this message out. Some of your time I will buy, I will pay for, but others of your time I will hope you will donate and make volunteer. But most importantly, stop by the booth, pick up our message, and share our message. HIV/AIDS prevention is a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week, 365-day-a-year job. we're never not doing this work. We should be talking to strangers and passerbyers. We should be talking to every member of our family. And definitely, we should be talking to people that we know are a part of a high-risk groups and high-risk communities and high-risk individuals who really need the message around HIV testing and the importance of care and treatment. So I solicit that. I took an opportunity to do a cheap public service announcement. Hopefully, I'm forgiven for it. But most important, I came here to say thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you, and have a wonderful conference.
And thank you, Chris. Good evening. It's a real pleasure and an honor to introduce a colleague and a friend, Dr. Kevin Fenton, Director of CDC's National Center for HIV/AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB Prevention. In just 2 short years, Dr. Fenton has made his mark on our center, on CDC, and indeed on the national response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Dr. Fenton attended medical school in his native Jamaica, and received his postgraduate training and specialization in public health medicine at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine in the University College London, where he was recently appointed as a visiting professor in epidemiology and public health. Between 2002 and 2004, Dr. Fenton served as the director of HIV and sexually transmitted infection department of the United Kingdom's Health Protection Agency. He was an investigator on the second British National Survey of Sexual Attitudes and Lifestyles and has designed and implemented a range of national studies on the epidemiology, prevention, and control of HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. Prior to becoming our National Center Director, Kevin served as chief of CDC's National Syphilis Elimination Effort. During his very active career, Dr. Fenton has directed and established a number of research programs and forums related to HIV/AIDS and sexual health, and has been a true champion for better understanding of the importance of racial, ethnic, and sexual diversity and disparities in public health. He is very deeply committed to assuring that this better understanding is translated into public health action that prevents infections and extends lives. Having worked in a center for 2 years, I can say without doubt that Kevin Fenton leads by example. He demands that each and every day we remember why we come to work at CDC and think about the people who are affected by our efforts. We have all been energized by Kevin's example to challenge ourselves to do our best and to make the most of our resources and our time, because the human immunodeficiency virus never takes a break and never slows down. No one is better suited to remind us all why we're here today. I introduce to you Dr. Kevin Fenton.
Thank you, Tim. And in the words of a famous friend, Christopher Bates, thank you, and thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome again to Atlanta and welcome to Georgia. And again, I want to extend this welcome on behalf of our conference co-chairs, Dr. Tim Mastro and Vicky Cargill. Before I begin this talk, which will be a brief introduction to where we are with HIV prevention in the United States and where we need to go, I'd like to issue a challenge. And that challenge is for you to participate, to engage, and to act to advance HIV prevention here in the United States and around the world as part of your participation in this meeting over the next couple of days. Now, many of us were involved yesterday with World AIDS Day related activities in our communities. For many, World AIDS Day is a time to reflect on the fact that 26 years and 6 months ago, on June 5, 1981, CDC published the MMWR report of pneumocystis pneumonia in 5 previously healthy young men in Los Angeles, California. These cases were later recognized as the first reported cases of AIDS in the United States. Since that time, this disease has become one of the greatest public health challenges, both nationally and globally. The recently released UNAIDS WHO global estimates show that the epidemic remains substantial, with an estimated 33.2 million people living with HIV globally in 2007. HIV/AIDS has claimed the lives of more than 22 million persons worldwide, including my friends, my family members, your friends, your family members as well. HIV/AIDS has claimed more than 500,000 persons in the United States. Despite major advances in prevention and treatment, Americans continue to become infected and lose their lives to AIDS at unacceptable rates. Today, more than 1 million Americans are living with HIV/AIDS. A quarter of these individuals are unaware of their HIV status, and another quarter who are infected are not in care. Milestones such as World AIDS Day are not only to commemorate those who we have lost, or to highlight many of the challenges faced in the fight against AIDS. But it also provides a time to reflect on some of the gains that we've made to date. Today, we pause on the importance of prevention, and we reflect on some of the tremendous successes we've had over the past two decades. Prevention of new cases of HIV infection has, in fact, been at the cornerstone of CDC's effort to halt the spread of this disease since it was first established and first described. The agency's overarching HIV prevention goal is to reduce the number of new HIV infections and to eliminate racial and ethnic disparities by supporting a full range of HIV prevention strategies, including HIV testing and prevention interventions with those living with HIV and those at high risk for contracting the virus. Now, there has been some progress in our fight against HIV/AIDS. We have seen dramatic declines in mother-to-child transmission of HIV. We've seen declines in HIV/AIDS cases in drug users. We've seen declines in risk behavior among youth in the United States, and studies repeatedly show that individuals who are living with HIV take steps to protect their partners and their loved ones from acquiring this disease. CDC's new recommendations on HIV screening and making HIV screening a routine part of medical care for all Americans aged 13 to 64 years is a major step forward. There have been new developments in rapid HIV testing technology combined with innovative approaches which show promising results. For example, using social networks to identify unknown positives and actively linking positives, people who are diagnosed newly positive, to care, which will be discussed at this meeting. We've also improved our ability to monitor the epidemic with new surveillance systems, increases in the number of states with confidential name-based reporting, and launching new behavioral surveillance systems, as well as new monitoring systems for HIV-infected individuals in care. But there is still unacceptable and severe impact of this disease, and there is an urgent need to accelerate progress. The reality is that HIV/AIDS remains a significant threat to America's health, with two groups being most severely affected: men who have sex with men of all races and African Americans. And the data are staggering. MSM account for nearly 50% of people living with HIV and more than half of new HIV diagnoses in 2005. Overall, African Americans, although accounting for just 13.5% of the U.S. population, accounted for half of all HIV diagnoses in 2005 in 33 states with confidential name-based reporting, and nearly half of people living with HIV in 2005. The rate of HIV among blacks is nearly 9 times higher than the rate in whites. And while the impact is perhaps not as severe among Latinos, Hispanics are also disproportionately affected by HIV, with a rate of diagnosis roughly 3.5 times that of whites. Now, while advances in treatment have greatly improved the lives of thousands of HIV-infected Americans, HIV remains a serious and fatal disease. And in 2005, in the United States, over 16,000 Americans with AIDS died. So in summary, we have seen important signs of progress, but HIV/AIDS among our families and within our communities remains unacceptable and remains severe. We know that proven interventions exist, but the reality is that too many people at risk are not being reached. for example, currently just over 20%, let me repeat that, 20% of men who have sex with men report receiving interventions which we know to be effective. As a nation, we must continue to invest in prevention, especially for the groups which I've mentioned before. We must do this more faster, and we must do this more efficiently. We need to reach critical mass with our prevention efforts and go beyond what we have done to date. This conference and our efforts cannot be just business as usual. At this conference, you have our commitment to strengthen our engagement with people and communities affected by HIV/AIDS, our commitment to strengthen collaboration and integration of HIV prevention across federal agencies, and to expand the search for solutions. For this 2007 conference, we've incorporated a host of new developments to meet these commitments. Some of these new developments include ensuring that each track has dedicated sessions on the impact of HIV/AIDS among ethnic communities, sexual minorities, with particular attention to African Americans, Hispanic and Latinos, and men who have sex with men. For this conference, we're expanding the outreach to Hispanic and Latino communities by developing conference materials, internet resources, specific sessions, all in Spanish, for the first time. At this conference, we're engaging and expanding our engagement with researchers and community members of minority communities through dedicated forums with CDC and leaders from our advisory committees to reflect upon the state of the HIV/AIDS epidemic, as well as other epidemics which are affecting these communities. At this conference, we're expanding tracks which focus on the synergies between science and program, with a particular emphasis on moving from knowledge to action. At this conference, we'll be highlighting our commitment to structural interventions for HIV/AIDS prevention through the establishment of a new track, Track G, specifically on program collaboration and service integration. At this conference, we'll be talking about new opportunities for advancing and integrating HIV prevention with domestic TB, STD, hepatitis prevention programs. And at this meeting, we'll be bringing leaders from other HHS agencies, from HRSA, from SAMHSA, from Indian Health Service, from NIH, and from CDC, to talk about how we can intensify federal collaboration to promote HIV prevention and increase joint programming and research in order to enhance our prevention efforts. At this conference, we will also reflect on the significant scientific and programmatic successes and continued challenges in our fight against HIV/AIDS. Data will be presented on the impact of routine HIV testing. Data will also be presented exploring trends towards earlier diagnosis of HIV among men who have sex with men and factors that contribute to the severe impact of HIV among African American men who have sex with men. Data will be presented on new effective prevention interventions which are planned for national dissemination in 2008. Now, CDC is committed to accelerating progress and expanding access to HIV prevention, and there are many new initiatives on the horizon. We continue to expand the number of effective interventions for infected and at-risk individuals. We are expanding access to testing and rapid testing. We have increased potential for new biomedical interventions with pre-exposure prophylaxis research underway and made new investments to identify new behavioral interventions for highest risk populations and new technology and systems to better track the epidemic. We have also launched the heightened national response to HIV/AIDS among African Americans, and this new initiative aims to expand the reach of prevention services, increase opportunities for diagnosing and treating HIV, developing new effective prevention interventions, and mobilizing broader community action among the African American community. Now, as we reflect upon our efforts to accelerate progress and to expand access to HIV prevention, I know that many of you will want to know the status of one of perhaps the most exciting developments in the area of strategic information and surveillance in the fight against HIV/AIDS. Recent reports have highlighted the fact that CDC is developing new estimates of HIV incidence for the U.S., and we are excited by these estimates, which will provide the clearest picture of HIV infections in the United States to date. The estimates are based on the first national system for directly measuring new HIV infections, and this has been made possible by new technology that can distinguish recent infections from long-standing infections. The estimates are currently being reviewed and analyzed by external experts prior to acceptance and publication in a scientific journal, and we anticipate releasing the data as soon as they are available. Given the enormous importance of these data for the nation's prevention efforts, this expert external peer review is important to ensure that the methodologies used and the conclusions derived are accurate. I look forward to speaking in greater detail about the new data when they're finalized and when they're published. We're also committed to increasing the number and scope of effective HIV prevention interventions, and I'm delighted to report that CDC has made substantial progress in this area. On Friday of last week, an updated compendium of evidence-based HIV interventions went live on the CDC website. This update uses more rigorous criteria for evaluating the evidence of efficacy for individual and small group-level interventions. And this update brings the number of effective interventions from the 24 identified in the original compendium to a total of 49 that meet new best evidence or promising evidence criteria. A special session will be held on Tuesday morning to provide more information and to answer your questions on this update. Now, CDC is also working to identify new criteria for studies evaluating community-level and structural interventions. In addition, we're working to increase the availability of intervention materials and trainings to you and your organizations. We are working to expand the use of 8 new scientifically proven interventions for a range of populations at risk, including African-American women and adolescents, Latino injecting drug users, incarcerated men, heterosexual African-Americans, and Latino couples. This is in addition to the more than a dozen DEBIs or programs which are already in use. At the same time, we still need innovative approaches for key risk groups, including African-American men who sex with men. CDC is testing a number of innovative behavioral interventions with this group, and to address immediate needs, we're supporting the adaptation of scientifically proven interventions, as well as testing promising biomedical approaches. Finally, we are confirming and reconfirming our commitment to addressing the societal issues which continue to drive HIV transmission in the United States today. For the individual, we all know that the determinants and the drivers include age, the presence of other sexually transmitted infections, circumcision status, nutritional status, immunogenetic factors, the type of exposure, and most critically, having sex with an infected partner. But we also know that the scientific data suggests that demographic, epidemiological, social, and political contexts directly influence the structure and dynamics of sexual networks and are in turn influenced by them. Other factors relevant to HIV transmission include the availability and cost of prevention services, legislation and law enforcement, and the role of the media in creating and reinforcing social norms. Societal and religious attitudes and tolerance towards marginalized and socially disadvantaged populations may impact the delivery and implementation of effective prevention interventions. Racism, homophobia, stigma, and discrimination are some of society's most difficult and long-standing challenges, and many have argued that they go beyond the scope of any single agency or sector. And certainly, tackling these issues cannot be resolved overnight. However, I firmly believe that change begins from within. Therefore, we must begin with our agencies to articulate a shared vision for tackling these issues. Now, more than ever, CDC is committed to working on solutions to structural issues in partnership with our government and non-governmental partners. We're involved in a number of activities across agency lines to address some of these societal factors, and it is my commitment that we will continue to collaborate across federal agencies to facilitate integrated, comprehensive approaches to HIV prevention. For example, we're partnering with the National Institutes of Health to look at how networks can influence rates of transmission of HIV and how networks can influence access to care. With HUD, we're studying how unstable housing affects adherence to medications, health and risk behavior among persons living with HIV. And we're increasing our joint consultations with NIH, HRSA, SAMHSA, and IHS to talk about structural, sociocultural research and programmatic efforts which are needed. We will continue to produce studies that look at the influence of discrimination, homophobia, stigma on risk behaviors. We will work to reduce stigma, whether through making routine HIV testing routine through our recommendations or using social marketing or health communication to tackle stigma against those living with HIV/AIDS. We will continue to build partnerships. We will continue to engage communities. And we will continue to expand the search for solutions. So I'd like to close now by giving a personal challenge to each of you as attendees to this conference. 26 years and 6 months into this epidemic, on the day after World AIDS Day 2007, let us begin this conference by reflecting and remembering those we love and those whom we've loved and lost. So much has passed, so much has been achieved, and the challenges seem so daunting. To the scientists in this room, I want to thank you for your work. I want to thank you for your dogged persistence in tackling the tough questions, for your creativity in the face of numerous challenges and difficulties in undertaking studies to benefit individuals and communities in the United States and around the world. To our program and our policy colleagues, whether working in state or local health departments, in NGOs or other federal agencies, thank you for your leadership, your persistence to continue the fight, your thoughtfulness and your mindfulness in getting services and policies to those in greatest need. To our community partners, thank you for persevering when the road seems incredibly rough, lonely, endless, and thankless. Know that the lives of many today and those who have passed depend and depended upon you and your leadership, your commitment, and your strength. Thank you all for your leadership and commitment to HIV prevention. I will end as I began by laying down the challenge for all of you to use this meeting to engage, to interact, to mobilize, and to act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Kevin, for those words. More so than in any public health crisis or infectious disease epidemic in history, persons living with HIV and AIDS have profoundly and positively influenced the response to this epidemic. I am honored to introduce our next speaker, Mr. Jesse Milan, whose passion, intelligence, and dedication have helped shape the national response to HIV/AIDS. Jesse has been living with HIV for 25 years. Mr. Milan is Vice President for the Constella Group. He is also currently Chairman of the Board of Directors of the Black AIDS Institute. Jesse Milan formerly served as the Project Director for the National Prevention Information Network, an initiative in conjunction with CDC. Mr. Milan has a broad and deep understanding of public health systems. In 2003, he was appointed by the U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services as co-chair of the newly created CDC-HRSA Advisory Committee on HIV and STD Prevention and Treatment. Before joining Constella, he was director of the AIDS Office for the City of Philadelphia Department of Public Health. Since 1998, he has toured several African nations at the request of the U.S. State Department, USAID, and CDC to promote public health awareness and program development. Jesse earned an undergraduate degree in public and international affairs from Princeton University and a law degree from New York University School of Law. It's a great pleasure to introduce a friend and a colleague, Jesse Milan.
When you get caught between the moon and New York City, I know it's crazy, but it's true. When you get caught between the moon and New York City, the best that you can do is... Now I know Kevin Fenton is sitting there wondering, why is this crazy black man singing that song at my conference? And actually, I'm wondering it myself. And the truth is, I've felt caught ever since I received the invitation to speak today. Caught between what you need me to say and what my heart asked me to say. Somebody has to say, we need a national plan for HIV/AIDS in America. Someone has to say that it is neither right nor proper that through the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, we require that all the nations that receive our money develop their own national plans, but we don't do it here. A coordinated national plan that would, in fact, assure that all of my brothers and sisters who are learning their HIV status have services available at HRSA and that CMS prepares to pay for them. All a national plan that would ensure that the Department of Labor deals with stigma in the workplace and discrimination. That the Department of Education assures that all publicly funded schools have comprehensive sexual health education. A comprehensive plan that calls on the Department of Justice to ensure real prevention in federal prisons. Somebody needs to say that. I might want to say thank you and congratulations, Kevin Fenton, for the heightened national response for African Americans. Thank you. It is, in fact, mobilizing black leadership in ways that's never been done before, but someone might need to say 35 million isn't enough, not to change the trajectory of HIV/AIDS amongst African American people. And some of you might want me to say we need a heightened national response for Latinos, Native Americans, and gay men of all colors. Someone might ask me to talk about flat budgets, that because of the calculation of recessions and inflation means that we're actually behind where we need to be for prevention budgets. Some of you might want me to comment on the extended CDC strategic plan for HIV prevention, which now has a goal by the end of the decade of reducing new infections by no less than 10%, which is a far cry from the original goal of reducing new infections by 50%. And some of you might want me to comment on the rumors of new HIV incidence data, or at least to say, why couldn't the peer review be completed by today? But the truth is, I've been hearing that song from that movie in my head since I got this invitation, because I've felt caught between December 1st and December 3rd. December 1st, World AIDS Day, when we contemplate all the really big issues and policies about HIV/AIDS in our nation and the world. But tomorrow, December 3rd, is the anniversary of my partner's death from AIDS. And frankly, all I can think about is love. From where I've been, I've learned that love and being caught really are at the core of this epidemic. I've traveled across America and Africa, and I've met men and women who are caught between the love they have and the love they fear to lose because of HIV and AIDS. Women who are afraid to ask their man to wear a condom or even to get an HIV test because of the love they might lose. Men so lacking in self-love and the stigma of their sexuality that they act out in unhealthy and riskful ways. People so bereft of love that they seek solace in drugs that alter their minds or their existence. If only all of them knew the love that I have had in this epidemic. If only all of them knew just how much you care. I learned about how important love is in this epidemic, not from a minister or an outreach worker, but from a scientist. I had the opportunity to have dinner with Dr. Robert Gallo, who, as you know, discovered the HIV virus. I told him I was going to talk to a lot of people, and I wondered, what would he have me say? And he said this, tell them three things. One, we are working as hard and as fast as we can. Two, there will be no vaccine or a cure for years and years. And three, until that time, prevention is the best medicine. And we sat silently and contemplated those words, and then his colleague, Dr. George Lewis, added something. He said, Jesse, please also tell them this. Tell them we are working out of love. My heart had not sung the way it did that day in a very long time. How many of you here are because of love, because of someone you've loved but lost to AIDS, because of someone whose life is affected by AIDS, love for our communities that are impacted by HIV and AIDS, or love for someone you hope never has HIV or AIDS. And what do? When you get caught? What do? When you get caught between all the attention on the global and no attention on the local? What do? When you get caught between the budget you have and the budget you need? What do? When you get caught between your boss and your community? When you get caught between the Debbies we got and the Debbies we ain't? What do? When you get caught with too much work and too little time? Well, we know the worst that you can do, because I've been there. When I got caught between my health commissioner and my ethics, I quit. But giving up does not help anyone we love. So what is the best that we can do? Well, look around. There are people here at this conference who truly love what they do. People who love building programs and policy and advocacy, and even people who love the data. There are people here who are doing their damnedest to not give up, even with no national plan, even with flat budgets and even with modest strategic goals. These people are the best. You know, throughout the 26 years that I've been involved in this epidemic, I've heard people say over and over that the best people work in HIV and AIDS. And I also know all too well that some of us have lost the best people we'll ever know to HIV and AIDS. But through our work, we have the opportunity to save millions and millions by delivering the best medicine available, the medicine of prevention. Will all those millions know how much you care? They may not, but you do. And so my dearest hope for you on this December 2nd, when I'm caught between all that you need me to say and all that I've been called to say, my dearest hope for you at this conference, when you're caught between how important and how hard this work is, that you remember just how much what you do is based on just how much you love. Thank you all.
Jesse, thank you very, very much. I'm very pleased to introduce a new friend and fellow New Yorker, Maritza De Jesus, who has been a tireless advocate for people living with HIV and AIDS. Ms. De Jesus was born in Hartford, Connecticut, of Puerto Rican ancestry. She was first diagnosed with HIV infection nearly 20 years ago in 1988. For several years, she served as a community leader and advocate both in New York City and here in Atlanta. For the past 10 years, she's been an active participant on Aid Atlanta's Speakers Bureau, using her experience and perspective to improve the lives of others. It's an honor to present to you Maritza De Jesus.
Hello, everyone. Can y'all hear me back there? We have a lot of folks here. This is wonderful. It really, really is. It shows that a lot of us are interested in the knowing, learning, sharing. My name is Maritza De Jesus, and I'm here to support everyone. Everyone. I am Latin, but I'm also here to support everyone. It doesn't matter what ethnic you are, but I'm here also to support my Latin people. And gracias por venir todos los Latinos. I am so sorry. That light is so bright in my eyes. So I'm going like this. I'm sorry. I want to start off by saying, if anyone here is infected with the virus or affected of the virus. Okay. And I was also thinking about those, like the times for me, I've been HIV positive going on 20 years. And by the grace of God, I have yet to take in any medication going on 20 years. And I was asking that question because I know there has to be someone here that's losing hope. Someone here that's either affected or infected and are losing hope. And I stand here to disclose my personal status. Don't give up. I'm here to share some of my personal stories. Discrimination, yes, I experienced that. Really, really bad. I've been with A Atlanta for going on 10 years, and I've been involved in a speakers bureau where I go out to the schools and I talk to the children, and I also go out to the college and speak to the students there. And my daughter, she'll be 22 real soon, and I would visit her school as well and talk to the students at her school. And I remember when the teachers found out about my status, my biggest prayer was that I didn't want them to treat my daughter bad, but they treated me bad. They didn't shake my hand anymore. They didn't say good morning to me when they saw me. Some of them did, some of them didn't. They did not sit beside me anymore. And that was my biggest fear, is disclosure. And I know there's a lot of people's fears, disclosure. And for everyone is different. You have to know when is the right time to tell and when not to tell. But for me, my background with being Latin, we love family. That's what keeps us going, is family. Family and friends and love is what keeps me going. And my daughter doesn't understand because she's mentally challenged. She's mentally retarded. She does not understand that mommy has HIV for 20 years now. For most all her life, she doesn't understand. She just understands when mommy has a bad day. You know, to be honest, I almost didn't make it today because for 2 weeks, I was just sick for 2 weeks. And all I can tell my daughter is that mommy belly hurts. And she doesn't understand that, but. And when I don't want to get out of bed, sometimes just seeing her next to me and knowing that she loves me, it helps a little bit. But I need y'all. I need CDC. Let's give a hand for CDC, please. If it wasn't for the education, I wouldn't know all that I know today. Education gives me strength. It gives me hope. And the more that I learn about this virus, the more I share. This is what we're here to do. Y'all need to share it to your loved ones. Don't keep it to yourself. Share it. You know, it's hope out there. There's still hope. I was sick for 2 weeks and it was so, so bad. I used to be much heavier. And this is the smallest I ever been. For people that don't know me, probably say she looks okay. But for the people that have known me in the past, I was much heavier than this. And sometimes it bothers me that I can actually wear the same size as my daughter today. When I used to wear a size 12. I remember when summertime, one summer we were going to the swimming pool and it hurt me to my heart and my daughter couldn't get in the swimming pool because as soon as I approached the water, every single kid in that pool got out the pool. And I didn't feel comfortable to get in the pool with my daughter. So I've experienced discrimination. And because it's people like CDC that have so much dedication and love to help people like myself and for those that are affected, it keeps me going. It keeps me going. A day like today to see everyone here, I mean, this is, I believe there's people like way back there. I can't really see that far, but it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. If no one say to y'all today that they love you, I do sincerely from my heart. Thank you. I go to... Thank you. Ooh, thank you. Let's not start anything, please. Okay. But I wanted to say, when I visit the schools, the youngest kids are 12 years old. And it's sad, but, you know, some of the kids that are 12 years old come up to me and say that they're HIV positive because either from their mother at birth or they were raped at 12 years old. I love what I do. I don't have a problem with disclosing myself. I love what I do. Because if I can save one life, then I'm my job is done. And my purpose today is to save another life. And I'm here to tell y'all that I need y'all as well. You know, and the little girl comes up to me. I remember it was one particular girl that came up to me. And as y'all can tell, I'm a very mushy person, right? I'm still in contact with her now. And that's been years ago, and she's doing really, really, really good. And I'm sharing that to say because I was available to her to teach her all that she needs to know about this virus and to share with her about hope. She didn't give up on herself. Because there's been a lot of days where I wanted to commit suicide. I'm not going to lie to you. It's been a lot of days. But I stand here still, like I say, and there is hope. I have wonderful people in my life. Find someone, even if it's just one person, find someone to talk to. If you haven't disclosed your status, share it with somebody. Please, I beg you, share it with someone that is sensitive to what you need to share to them. Don't keep it bowed inside. And New York is where I started doing my advocacy and educating people in New York. And I actually remember going out to the community for the community that used to use intravenous needles. I used to use drugs, and it's been, I'm going on 21 years in recovery now. And that's to say, for those that are struggling with using drugs, there's hope. There's hope, because I'm standing here 21 years clean, and there's hope. I don't know what else to say. It's just so much that I want to say, but I don't want to come off the subject. I'm just keeping on my personal story. But the more y'all participate and ask questions, what you don't understand, what you don't know, ask questions, please, and reach out and call and ask all the questions that you don't know, because that's how we help each other out. That's how we can help out the doctors and CDC and everyone. We have to ask questions. We have to participate. Clinical trials, be involved. This is what keeps us to learn more and to learn how to live a more healthier life with quality. I keep going because I don't want to live in a house of fear and scared and no hope. I want to live with some quality in my life. You know, I'm going to share this, and it's kind of off the subject a little bit, but I've had, like, my hair was, like, really long to my waist. And I have a lot of grays And I dyed it for the first time. I dyed my hair because I wanted some change. I cut my hair off and I dyed my hair. And I know it's off the subject, but, you know, I needed to do something different. I needed to change. And I did it. You know, I want to live is what I'm saying. I want to live. So, for anyone else, again, that's newly diagnosed, especially, or for anyone that's here today that just wants to give up, my heart goes out to you, and I'm here to say, please don't give up. Thank you.
Good evening. I think that what we've heard from those two people is so important, y'all need to stand up and applaud them and support them again. Thank you to both of you. I'm actually going to have y'all stand up again in a minute, so this is clearly the aerobics portion of today's program. It is good to see so many faces. I agree with Maritza. Ooh, honey, it's bright. And, you know, I'm getting too old to have this camera this close to my face, so y'all need to back it up. These people don't be seeing all these crow's feet and stuff. That's what the epidemic will do to you, so back that up. We've heard a lot this evening, and it's been, at least for me, very powerful to go backwards as well as to look forward. But before I do my co-chair task, I want to ask you to think about something that's often said, which I believe is very true. We can't move forward unless we look to where we've been. We've heard a lot about people who've made a great contribution. I want to take a moment to talk about someone that I had the good fortune to know, who is not going to be with us today physically, but I believe in my heart somewhere Janet is here with us in spirit. And that is, I want to talk about Dr. Janet Mitchell. Thank you. For some of you who've known Janet, you know it's been a tough year. But I'm determined we're not going to forget everything that Janet has done. Because we stand on the shoulders of giants, every single one of us in this room, and we need not to forget that. Because at the end of the day, it's going to be up to us to move forward and to make it happen. And that's because those giants pushed us into place. Because this is going to be a long marathon tag team. So don't get comfortable. Let's just keep it moving. And Janet did that. Janet was the daughter of a butler and a domestic. And with financial aid, she went to Mount Holyoke. In fact, Janet graduated a year ahead of me. So now y'all know how old I am, too. But keep that under wraps. But Janet went on to become the chief of perinatology in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at Harlem Center Hospital. But more importantly, Janet had the largest clinic for pregnant women who also were dealing with HIV and substance use. And as if that weren't enough, Janet lobbied the NIH to include pregnant women and black pregnant women in clinical trials of AIDS drugs. And for that alone, we all ought to say, thank you, Janet. But she didn't stop there, because we heard people talk about love. Janet would send hospital staff out to people who didn't show up for clinic because they needed to be in the clinic to be okay. She has written over 50 peer-reviewed articles. She was critical to developing a panel for pregnant substance abusing women. She has certainly made her mark in terms of reports that were convened by the Institute of Medicine, and I'm going to ask you to stand and salute Janet with your applause to let her know, Janet, we thank you for your contribution. Now, my next job is certainly a pleasurable one for someone who is still with us, thankfully, and whose name is synonymous with HIV prevention and embodies it. And that is, I get the wonderful honor, privilege, and fun to introduce my good friend and colleague, Dr. Tom Coates. Thomas J. Coates is the director of the UCLA Program in Global Health and is the Michael and Sue Steinberg Endowed Professor of Global AIDS Research within the Division of Infectious Diseases at UCLA. He co-founded the Center for AIDS Prevention Studies, known affectionately as CAPS, at UCSF in 1986 and directed it from 1991 to 2003. He was the founding executive director of the UCSF AIDS Research Institute, leading it from 1996 to 2003. Many of you know Tom's work. We sometimes perhaps even take it for granted. But his areas of emphasis and expertise are HIV prevention, the relationship of prevention and treatment for HIV, and HIV policies. Certainly his domestic work has focused on a number and variety of populations, and he is currently finishing a nationwide clinical trial of an experimental HIV prevention intervention focused on high-risk men. He is also finishing domestic trials of post-exposure prophylaxis. And as if that isn't enough to keep Tom busy, he is the co-principal investigator of the NIAID-funded HIV Prevention Trials Network and is conducting policy research both domestically and internationally. He was elected to the Institute of Medicine in 2000, showing they have excellent taste and sense. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Tom Coates.
Thank you so much. Thank you. I'm incredibly honored to be here. I was honored when the CDC asked me to give this presentation. I'm also inspired. I'm inspired by the talks that have preceded me. I'm inspired by the speakers and the talk of love and hope. And that's what we're all here for, is to inspire ourselves, to bring hope to one another, and to continue the long trek that we have to take. I want to thank the CDC for organizing this conference, but also especially for organizing the theme of the conference, promoting synergy between science and program. Science can inform program, and program needs to inform science, and that's a theme I'm going to come back to. Are we spending our science dollars as wisely as we can in the service of the kinds of programs that need to happen? Now, as Dr. Fenton mentioned, there have been, it's always frustrating to come to a meeting like this, and we think of everything that we have to do, and we think of all of the infections that are occurring, and we think of the tremendous social injustice that exists in our world. And it's frustrating, and we think, how are we ever going to get there? But you know, every once in a while, there are breakthroughs. 27 generals, retired generals of the United States Army, signed a petition to reverse the don't ask, don't tell policy and to allow gays to serve in the military. And it was just not that long ago that President Clinton struggled with that decision. So change does happen, but it does happen over a long period of time. I think it's useful, as Dr. Fenton reminded us, that there have been some advances. Antiretroviral medications are the reason that a lot of us are here. Prevention of mother-to-child transmission has been an incredible public health success in the United States. Declines in risk behavior among youth around the world and in the United States, reflected by delay in onset of first intercourse and condom use at first and last intercourse. Syringe access. There was a recent MMWR on syringe access in the United States where no federal dollars can be spent on clean needles and syringes, and yet we've mounted a tremendously important response through private, state, and local dollars. The trials of male circumcision hold promise both for the United States and around the world, and I doubt that the artist who painted this on a wall in some pyramid in Egypt realized how famous this painting would become. But the thing he didn't realize is while he has focus on the anatomy, it seems like his arm length is a bit long. Not sure what that guy's trying to do with his arm. Or, you know, the other thing is the Egyptians were mathematical geniuses, but they didn't get the correlation between penis length and arm length. And I think that's probably one of the major problems. One of the things that male circumcision has brought out, though, is this talk about biomedical prevention. And we talk about treatment versus prevention. We talk about structural interventions. And I think the thing that we have to remember that on the ground, there is no biomedical prevention or structural prevention. Prevention is prevention. And the best prevention includes everything so that we have highly active HIV prevention. So that what we need to be prepared to do is use the best of everything. That is, infected people getting treatment, behavioral change, biomedical strategies when they prove efficacious, social justice and human rights, in a context of community involvement and leadership. That's prevention, and that's the highly active prevention that we need to be seeking here and around the world. Other major successes in HIV voluntary counseling and testing and improved surveillance. And in the community-based response in advocacy and activism, and that creates a comprehensive prevention picture. Now, when I was asked to give a title for the talk, I said, how could we lower the worldwide incidence from 3 million to under 2 million? Well, the UNAIDS did that for me. They issued revised numbers. So I'm revising my estimate to say, how can we go from 2 million to less than 1 million? Now, the New York Times really got it wrong. And I could just blast them into the sun. They deserve to be taken over by Rupert Murdoch. When they wrote about this, they said, well, was there some kind of conspiracy? Or does this now mean that the HIV epidemic is plateauing out? Well, I've got news for you. If it's plateauing out, it's plateauing out at too high. 2.5 million infections a year worldwide are just too many, and especially when it includes almost 420,000, probably 500,000 individuals under the age of 15. If that's a plateau, that's a totally unacceptable plateau. And it's no cause for joy. So what do we do? Now again, you see these plans and you see these strategies and you see these reports, and they get long and ponderous, and what I'm going to give you is 5 actionable items. None of them are easy, none of them are simple, but they are measurable, and I think this is what we should do to lower HIV incidence worldwide. First is more rapid rollout of effective strategies. VCT, ARV access, prevention of mother-to-child transmission, male circumcision, syringe access, and drug treatment. If we did those 5 things, we would accomplish a lot. Take prevention of mother-to-child transmission. Only 10% of HIV-infected women in the world have access to antiretrovirals to reduce mother-to-child transmission. That's unconscionable. When we can virtually prevent every last case of prevention of mother-to-child transmission if we just treat the mother's HIV. Now, yes, there's variability. Botswana has 50% coverage. South Africa has 30 to 40% coverage. But that means that they're pulling the average up. The U.S. could have virtually 100% coverage if we organized our services right. National plan. But 10% is not acceptable. ARV access has been a huge success, and the rollout and the roll-up is continuing, but we have additional challenges. What are we going to do when the second-line treatment wears out? What are we going to do about third-line treatment? What about pediatric formulations? What about healthcare resources? What about syringe access and drug treatment and substitution treatment in places that don't allow it in the world? Step 2, focus on youth. So even in this new UNAIDS report, 60% of the new infections worldwide are women. 68% are in sub-Saharan Africa. The majority are under the age of 25. There still are 11.4 million AIDS orphans in the world. 500,000 children under HIV with HIV under 12 with HIV infected last year. And we need to include young men. So we need a focus on youth. And then there are the regional disparities. Sub-Saharan Africa does bear the greatest burden of HIV disease, but there is the Caribbean. There's Latin America with its MSM epidemic. There's Eastern Europe with its drug use epidemic. There's the Northern African region and the Asian region. So as we're focused on Sub-Saharan Africa, we can't forget that. Step 3 is education. And this is not HIV education, but just education. Education changes life. And especially safe education for young women changes their lives. It gives them options. If we did nothing else, in fact, the best predictor of reduced fertility in the developing world, that is, lower number of children, is increasing educational status for women. If we did nothing else but provide safe education for women so that every woman in the world was guaranteed at least a secondary education degree, it would reduce HIV, I guarantee you. Step four is equity, especially gender equity. We need to move from rhetoric to action. We need to realize that gender does not equal women, but gender also equals men. Every advocacy movement needs an enemy. Think about it. In the early days of the epidemic, it was Ronald Reagan. There have been various enemies here, hither, thither, and yon. And as women began to bear the brunt of HIV, and as it became clear that gender disparity was a major cause of AIDS, men became the enemy. Now, men do bad things. Some men do bad things. Some men do things that are irresponsible. But the focus on men and men as perpetrators of disease, in fact, there's been this change. At first, women were portrayed as vectors of the disease, and now men are portrayed as vectors of the disease. Led one reporter at the Toronto AIDS conference to say changing the behavior of African men is probably hopeless. Well, that's a terrible thing to say. Yes, we do need a new masculinity, but men are not the enemy. Men and women need to move together to protect one another, and we need a new masculinity. And step five, always advocacy and accountability. Local leadership, local community response, and local and global accountability, including all governments. The U.S. government takes a lot of heat. Got to keep the heat on. That's okay. Local governments need the heat too, because they don't always respond as effectively or rapidly or as efficiently as they need to. Foundations, particularly large private foundations, pouring a lot of money into this epidemic, and I'm glad that they are, but there needs to be accountability there too. Accountability at all levels. Now, what about the domestic HIV prevention agenda? So again, when I gave the title, I said, well, 40 or 45,000 down to 25,000. Now the Washington Post tells us it's going to be 60,000. And the question is this better surveillance or is this an actual increase? It kind of doesn't matter. The important point is that it's better surveillance and that we're going to have a better number. And this 40,000 number that's been floating around for all of these years that was kind of made up as best they could years ago really does need to go by the wayside. So better numbers are going to help us understand how much epidemic there is and how to make the situation better. Now, what do we need to do? Step one is focus. And looking over the program of this meeting, it's clear that we have focus. If we look at the best estimates of new HIV infections, about 27% of them have occurred among Black and Hispanic men who have sex with men, and 16% among non-MSM, kind of equally split between people who are categorized as heterosexual or as IDU. You know, you can't quite be both, I guess. And you can be, but not as it's counted, so it gets a little bit complicated. But as it's counted, I mean, it's the best they can do. About 24% are among white MSM, and about 3% among non-white MSM, and about split between 1 and 2%. So there we have about, you know, 60, 70% of the epidemic, clearly largely represented by Black and Hispanic MSM, but about 50% being MSM. Also among women, about 70% of the cases are Black or Hispanic heterosexual women. So that's where the three foci need to be. Among MSM generally, among Black and Latino MSM, and among Black and Latino women. We can do something about that. Now we know a few things about the minority HIV epidemic. We know that if you're black and Latino, you're less likely to know your serostatus. We know that if you're black and Latino, you're more likely to die sooner from HIV and AIDS. You're more likely to be diagnosed later in your illness. So our goal, we have a very measurable outcome, and that is to get rid of disparities in serostatus knowledge and to get rid of disparities in mortality. Those are achievable goals. These are data from the CDC, 15 to 29 years old, young people, unaware of their status, and it just repeats information that we already know. And it does matter. These are data from Project Explore. And unprotected receptive anal intercourse among men who have sex with men, either with unknown status partners or negative partners, is as risky as with a positive partner. Knowledge of serostatus really does matter. We know about the disproportionate mortality where men with African-American men with HIV are 6 to 9 times more likely to die from HIV than white men. Women, the ratios are up to the 13%. That's unconscionable, and that's not okay, and there is something we can do about that. Step 3, of course, is substances. And we know that substances, especially stimulants, are a driving force in the epidemic. These are data from the CDC National Health Behavior Survey, the 12-month prevalence of stimulant use. You can see the percentages. This is a survey of men who have sex with men. These are data from San Francisco, and even if you look at the data from across the country, you can see that stimulant use does not discriminate. It's a driving force in the epidemic of MSM among African Americans, among Latinos, and among white and Asian Americans, as well as probably Native Americans. In the Project Explore, even though 25% of the individuals reported less than weekly or weekly more stimulant use, they accounted for almost half of the new infections that we observed in that study. Clearly, something needs to be done about this. This is a national emergency. Now, what do? We need new treatment strategies. We need community leadership from within the gay community. We need supply-side interruption, but we need other creative strategies to do something about this, and this should be a priority. I know it's been made a priority of the CDC. It needs to be a priority of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. This needs to be one of their highest priorities to do something about this epidemic. Step 4 is it's time for AIDS service organizations that have served our community so well to change. And it may mean changing strategies, learning new expertises, and changing delivery methods. Let me talk about each of those. In terms of strategies, and I appreciate the work that the CDC has done to come up with scientifically validated methods of HIV prevention, the DEBIs. But it's a great compendium, and I'm not saying that those shouldn't be used. As you remember, going back, we have a comprehensive, highly active HIV prevention strategy. But the strategies may need to be expand. In addition to counseling people, in addition to trying to motivate people, in addition to using the cognitive behavioral strategies, we may need other strategies. We certainly need structural interventions. We certainly need network interventions. We may need new kinds of motivations, like economic motivations. New York City Schools is experimenting with reimbursement for young people who finish high school. What's wrong with that? That's a good strategy. It's been experimented with in Mexico and in the UK, and it's proven highly efficacious, and it's extremely motivating. It's been used with stimulant users. Again, it's highly efficacious, and we need to incorporate these strategies into our public health response. In terms of expertise, AIDS service organizations, especially those not involved in clinical care or in clinical activities, need to learn that expertise or partner with organizations that have it. Because we now have male circumcision, we may have pre-exposure prophylaxis, we may have provision of acyclovir, we may have microbicides, and we need organizations with on-the-ground expertise to partner with clinical groups so that when these strategies come along, they can be disseminated quickly to the communities that need them the most. In the case of male circumcision, for example, it's an extremely effective strategy, and yet we waited until the clinical trials were done to begin gearing up. We can't do that in the United States. We need to get these life-saving strategies out as soon as possible. And as far as delivery methods goes, there are a lot of sessions devoted in this conference to the internet, which, be it as it may, where we try to deliver messages over the internet, that people go there for other reasons and for other motivations. And there are other delivery methods that we need to test out besides face-to-face communication. Technology is the order of the day, and there may be other methods as well that we need to experiment with. Step 5, of course, is advocacy and accountability. National plan. And I did not talk to Jesse before we got together. And I did not add this after he talked. But the national plan, to be useful, needs very clear goals and doesn't need 100 of them. I think 5 are fine. The strategies need to be implementable, the outcomes need to be measurable, and the resources need to be there to implement them. And I think that's what we need to advocate for. And one of the presidential candidates, and I won't mention her name, has promised to double the NIH's AIDS research budget. But what would we do with 2 times the budget? Will it match programmatic needs? And unless it's tied closely to programmatic needs, it's not going to be worth it. We won't spend it wisely. And I think that's what we have to advocate for. Finally, in terms of advocacy, I love our biannual meetings. I find them energizing. The meeting in Toronto, the next meeting in Mexico City, I love them. And I find it very exciting that this is the only disease in the world that people working on all aspects of the disease, community advocates, people with the disease, get together and re-energize each other. But we need to move it from a biannual rally where we re-energize each other to also something where we also move to accountability and action. And that is an important shift that needs to occur. So on to the future. And that's what this is all about. I think if we implemented my 5 steps or my 10 steps, my 5 international, my 5 domestic steps, I think we could bring down the incidence of new cases of HIV if we were serious about it. This young man is looking to the future, and we hope he does have a future, and we hope that he does see the day that the sun does set on his life, and that it's a good long life. But HIV, I think, is important, and it's more than a disease, it's an important disease, because what it does is point at everything that's wrong with society. And it points at all the disparities and all the injustices. And while we're working on specific solutions, I know it is those injustices and the desire for a more just society that motivates many of us. With that, I invite you, Tuesday, December 4th, to a rally and a dinner. So there's a dinner. Shining a light on gaps in HIV and prevention. There's a march and rally for prevention justice. Which will convene at the Hyatt Hotel across the street at the corner of Baker and Peachtree. And then afterwards, there'll be a prevention justice dinner and strategy session at St. Luke's Church. That's what this is about. This is about justice. It's about taking that fence down that's preventing that young man from realizing his potential. Thank you very much.
Tom, thank you so much for those very, very inspirational words. Now, behind every great conference, there is a wonderful conference organizer, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Mr. Bob Komischer, who's been working with us as the conference co-chairs over the past 2 years to prepare this conference. And I'll just give a story about Bob. Bob is incredible. He manages to work quietly, diligently behind the scenes, and somehow manages to get an incredible amount done in between the times that we've been meeting to plan this conference. But there's also another story, because we all came to this conference fairly new. I started in the role in January of last year. Tim Mastro had not been the co-chair of the conference before, and Vicky Cargill hadn't either. And if it wasn't to make it even more complicated, neither had Bob. So we began looking at the template for this conference, beginning to think, how do we need to move this conference forward? How do we need to meet the needs of the evolving epidemic? And how do we need to engage you in the fight against HIV? So it's with great pleasure that I'd like to welcome Bob to the stage to take us through some housekeeping issues and to introduce the rest of the agenda. Bob.
Thank you all very much. Maritza asked the question, are there people way in the back? Are there people way in the back? There are a lot of you here. Well, as you've heard from Dr. Fenton, we've planned a very informative and exciting conference for you. To take maximum advantage of the conference, I'm going to ask you to do some homework tonight, and I'm very serious about that. You need to spend at least 15 to 30 minutes this evening reviewing your program guide after you return to your rooms late this evening to ensure that you maximize this experience at this conference, to ensure that you attend the sessions of greatest interest to you. I'd also like to point out at the beginning of this conference that you won't see any paper evaluation forms. For a conference this size, we could use up to 50,000 sheets of paper. That information would need to be transcribed into a database, and this is typically what happens at conferences this large. For this conference, we'll be using an electronic evaluation form. After you leave this conference, we won't forget about you. You'll receive email reminders from us to complete an online evaluation. We'll even provide you with incentives to do so. So be looking for some of those exciting incentives, and we hope that you'll justify our decision to go electronic. Now, a few quick thanks before we begin this evening's entertainment. I want to thank our conference contractor, Team PSA, for everything you see at this conference. They were responsible for literally everything that you see here this evening. They have been a wonderful partner to work with. Their staff, wearing red shirts, are available to answer any of your questions. I also want to thank NMAC for handling the conference registration. As you know, they just completed their own conference, USCA, a few short weeks ago. And I'd also like to thank the CDC staff who have helped make this conference happen. They are available at the conference to assist you with any questions you have, and look for these yellow staff or gold staff ribbons. So if you have questions, remember to ask them. And finally, we have a number of volunteers who will guide you during this session. They're wearing yellow shirts. So you've got a lot of people at your disposal. You're going to have problems. You're going to be mixed up and confused. You're going to have problems. We're here to solve those problems for you. For persons living with HIV/AIDS, you are very special to us. We have a lounge reserved for you, room 226, in where the hotel rooms are located. That's right next to the CDC staff room. So if you feel like you need to rest, if you need some nourishment or whatever, if you need a place to refrigerate medications or whatever, we have a room for you. And then finally, I'd like to thank Kroger Grocery Stores for donating 7,200 bottles of water next time you go to Kroger. One of our staff called the Kroger stores here in Atlanta, and he had a friend, and they came through. So anytime you go into Kroger, think about their dedication. Now, in just a few minutes, we'll begin our entertainment for the opening session. After this entertainment, we'll invite you to walk across the street to the Marriott Hotel to enjoy our welcoming reception in the Imperial Ballroom, where we'll have not just entertainment, but hors d'oeuvres and snacks of all sorts. At the opening reception, Cathay Atlantic Art Ensemble will be performing. This group is a Chinese group that consists of a chorus group, and are you ready for this? 60 dancers. And then, right after that, we have a surprise performance. The group, One Chance, Usher's group, will be performing live for you. So let's hear it for Usher. We don't know that he's showing up, but his group will be here, and I'm sure you'll enjoy his music. All right. On Monday evening, we have the NGO Village, also in the Marriott, which will feature a variety of entertainment. On Tuesday evening, the play Divine Intervention will be performed. This play highlights how HIV/AIDS has affected African-American women. Also on Tuesday evening, we have a video addressing what it's like to be Latino and gay, bisexual, and transgender in the times of AIDS. So it's a lot of activity going on Tuesday night. And again, do your homework and plan your time wisely. And finally, in our closing ceremony on Wednesday, Enrique Mercado will be performing, and you don't want to miss his exciting performance. And now I'd like to introduce to you Rufus Mitchell, who will introduce our entertainment. Some of you may have been members of a fraternity or sorority while in college. My guess is that few of you have actually built on that relationship to make a lifelong commitment through your fraternity or sorority for the betterment of your community. Well, I'd like to introduce to you a friend and a colleague who has actually done that. Rufus Mitchell of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity. Rufus works at CDC in the Division of HIV/AIDS Prevention as a business analyst. And Rufus, you want to come on up? And
this is Thank you very much, Bob.
Made his college experience part of his daily life even today. 40 years later?
Okay. Just a few years later. Okay.
Thanks, Bob. All right, Rufus.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the entertainment segment of the opening session. The Clark Atlanta University Drumline is directed by Cecil H. Houston II. This distinguished drumline is part of the only band to participate in the National Honda Battle of the Band for 5 consecutive years. The drumline you will hear today has been featured on the Judge Hatchett Show and the Ellen DeGeneres Show. The band was also featured in the movie Drumline. I'm sure a few of you saw that. Commercials for McDonald's and the City of Atlanta are included in their credentials. And now, please welcome the nationally acclaimed Clark Atlanta University Drumline. Thank you, Clark Atlanta University Drumline. Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity was founded at Cornell University in 1906. We celebrated our centennial anniversary in 2006 with a huge convention in Washington, D.C. Today we have chapters at most colleges and universities across and throughout the United States and most territories. The aims of our fraternity, manly deeds, scholarship, and love for all mankind. The national programs of our fraternity include Go to High School, Go to College. This was began in 1922. Voter education registration began in the 1930s, and Project Alpha, which began in 1980 and has been conducted in partnership with the March of Dimes since 1982. Clark Atlanta chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha is the Alpha Phi chapter. They have conducted three Project Alpha sessions, and most recently they conducted Project Alpha on November 23rd, and approximately 500 young men learned how to prevent HIV, STD, and pregnancies. Other programs at Clark Atlanta University with the Alpha Phi chapter include the AIDS Walk Atlanta, Dress for Success, Campus Cleanup, Brother to Brother, and Brother to Brother is a series where Clark Atlanta University young men come together to build brotherhood. Servants of all, they worked in the cafeteria at Clark Atlanta to serve meals during holidays. They participated in Hosea Feed the Hungry, and they also did a Miracle Food Basket Network for about 20 families. And they also conducted a Voteless People as a Hopeless People, where they registered many new voters in the United States. And now, the 2007 National Championship Step Team from Miami, Florida at the National Convention, the Alpha Phi Chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated. A Phi!
We are the brothers of the Phi. We are the brothers of you already know. We are the ice cold brothers of A Phi A R.
We gon' break it like
ice. A Phi. Thank you.
5, 8, step.
All right, 8-5-8. We'd like to thank you for attending the opening session of the 2007 Prevention Conference. Please join us across the street at the Marriott. Opening reception is there. As Bob Komescher noted earlier, there will be refreshments and hors d'oeuvres and live entertainment. Please exit to your right, and conference volunteers will provide additional direction. Thank you again.